brings in air to their smelling glands.
Okay. Well, I guess that about exhausts the subject, Doctor. I want to thank you for coming by. I know we all know a good deal more now about the Komodo dragon than we did a few moments ago. Do you have a ride home?
No, I don't.
Well, maybe somebody here in the audience will give you a lift after the
very
show.
Kind of them if they
would. Why don't you stand over there, okay?
Hello, this is It's Your Body. My name is Chris, and I am filling in tonight or subbing for It's Your Body. It's Your Body is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Michael Schuhl, clinical psychologist, offering psychotherapy for adults and play therapy for children. Dr. Schuhl helps people find meaning and depth in their lives and deal with issues including depression, anxiety, trauma, and works with children as young as 5. Located in Chico, Dr. Schuhl can be reached at 891-6292. And by the Chico Women's Club, built in 1913, the historic Chico Women's Club is available for classes, events, concerts, wedding, and celebrations. Located at the entry to Bidwell Park, the Chico Women's Club offers a truly classic setting with modern amenities. Visit chicowomensclub.org for more information and appointments. This is KZFR, Community Radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. And again, the show at 6 o'clock, 6 to 7, is It's Your Body. And we would like to thank all of you again, including Friends of the Arts, a state local partner to the Chico Arts Council. Since 2001, Chico Friends of the Arts has been creating economic opportunity through arts and culture by producing community festival and events, including Artoberfest, Chico Paleo, the True North Tour, the Silent Film Festival, the NorCal Jazz Festival, the Salmon Festival, and more. To learn about Friends of the Arts, visit friendsoftheartsupstate.org. And by Red Hot Metal, home of cutting-edge products, metalwork of all kinds, industrial to artistic, also offering the world's finest glass working tools for the glass artist. So it is, besides being Domestic Violence Awareness Month, it is also Breast Cancer Awareness Month. And so I'm going to be getting on the phone with me Patty Molinaro from the California Health Collaborative. She's a clinical coordinator for the Every Woman Counts program. And she will be talking to us a little bit about some of the concerns about breast cancer screening in our local area. So give me a second to do that. I'm going to put on a song for you and be right back with you.
Quite a tea. Sugar, I remember sugar. Not much of a looker. Oh, but what a dream. I remember coffee flavored Haagen-Dazs sweetening my lips. Now it's just a but it became a habit that was hard to lick. Oh, yes, and I remember Fannie Mae, but
all those great foods that sometimes we don't get to eat as much as we would like to. I have on the phone with me, I hope, Patty Molinaro, Clinical Coordinator for the Every Woman Counts program, and Breast Cancer Nurse Navigator. Are you there, Patty?
I am.
Yay.
Can you hear me okay, Chris?
Yeah, you're fine.
Okay.
And I wanted to ask you, first of all, about Breast Cancer Awareness Month in our local area. Is there anything special going on this month?
Well, there are. Enloe Hospital is actually having on Monday the 17th, I think it's 5:30 to 7, they have a meet and greet for the local public to meet their new oncologist. We have obtained a new breast surgeon in our area within the last year and a half, along that works in with Dr. Schrader, Dr. Ching, and then as well, we have a total of 6 medical oncologists now.
Wow.
Who are in need because some have retired, and so we had been using locum tenens, which were doctors who came in to fill in, and we just recently hired 2 new female oncologists, and then Dr. Whitlatch, who had left for a while, has returned as well. So we're doing pretty good now with medical oncologists.
Well, that it's good in a way, and it's bad in another because there's so many women with breast cancer.
Unfortunately, there is a need. Well, it's not just breast cancer; it's all cancers,
right?
That they treat. But yes, it doesn't appear to be going away anytime soon.
Well, your end of things starts with screening and diagnosis, and can you tell us, a lot of women get delayed treatment because they don't think that they have the financial ability to get screening, even if they feel like they might have a lump. So can you walk us through the Every Woman Counts program, like who qualifies, where do you get services?
Sure. Well, here in Chico, we have 4 facilities that enroll women: the Women's Health Specialist, the AMPLA Clinic, Northern Valley Indian Health, and Butte County Public Health. And then, of course, in Oroville, we have multiple areas with Oroville Outpatient Center, physicians, as well as the Oroville Public Health and the AMPLA Public Health, and Feather River Tribal. So in Butte County, we have, pretty good number of providers. And then in Glenn County, we have both Hamilton City and Orland AMPLA. And then we have a new, fairly new, about the last year and a half to 2 years, AMPLA in Las Molinas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In Red Bluff, there's just one site right now, and that's the Tehama Public Health Services, and in Calusa we have a couple locations. So a woman who thinks she may qualify has a couple ways that she can actually find a provider. We have a 1-800 number, and that number is now automated, so the woman can just call that number and then put in her zip code. She can specify her language first, and then she puts in her zip code, and she'll be receive a list of providers in her zip code area.
What's that number, Patty?
I knew you'd ask me that.
Oh, darn.
I'll get it for you before we're done.
What a troublemaker.
I don't have it memorized. It's on the brochure.
But, okay.
And I'm not at my desk. I have it on my brochure in my desk.
Okay.
But I'll get it for you.
So somebody could go to Cancer Detection Program and find that 800 number?
Well, they can just go online, actually. We have an online provider locator now, which is new. So they can just go in and Google Every Woman Counts provider locator.
Oh,
and
good.
That will also allow them to put in their zip code, and it'll allow them then to get a group of providers in their zip code area or an adjoining zip code if there isn't one specific to theirs.
Okay. Now, I know that a lot of women use some of the clinics that you mentioned, but maybe they don't know that there's, they may have some insurance, but they've been told that they don't qualify for this or that. So tell us about, not to get into all the nuances, but I know there's something called being underinsured, and maybe you can tell us about the how to qualify for these programs that do all the screening.
Right. So our income guideline is considered 200% of the federal poverty, and for a single individual, that would be about $1,980 a month. It goes up with each person in the family. The allowance is a little bit higher. And the program allows for women who have no insurance or are considered underinsured. And at this point in time, underinsured is designated as copays or deductibles that the woman feels that she cannot personally meet. So there's not an actual number.
Mm-hmm.
We recently have also acquired approval to enroll women with Medicare who have A and B. In the past, we would only be able to enroll women with Medicare A only. And our guidelines stated if they have Medicare B, that they wouldn't be. But now that has been changed. We can allow women who have Medicare A and B who can't handle their 20% if they don't have a supplement to, you know, get enrolled in our program. When women have an insurance, especially some of the new California Exchange programs, they are required to cover their screening mammograms. And so a woman may have a screening mammogram paid for and then develop an abnormality or have an abnormality, you know, found on her mammogram. At that point, she now has to meet her deductible before anything is covered. That woman can now access Every Woman Counts, just like the traditional insurance programs where women who have deductibles or copays can access Every Woman Counts. And again, we do not specify the amount that you have to have out of pocket, just that the woman cannot handle that copay or deductible. As long as she meets that 200% of the federal poverty, she can be enrolled in Every Woman Counts. So we are educating our providers to be aware of the fact that many women will come into the system on one of the California Exchange programs and have complete coverage for their clinical exam and their screening mammogram, but may at that point develop an abnormality on their screening, which now allows them to be enrolled into the Every Woman Counts for their diagnostic imaging.
Yeah, that's really good. And when you say women, what ages are you talking about?
Well, currently we are covering women 40 and over for our breast screening and diagnostic services. However, there is a bill that has been actually introduced into the Assembly and the Senate and passed by both, and sent off to the governor, and he signed that on August 25th. And that bill will allow women who are under 40 who are symptomatic to be covered for diagnostic imaging with our program. That has not taken effect. We have not been given the date. We have been told that they're in the process of defining the criteria of what they are considering symptomatic. It will take effect in 2017. We're just not sure if it's going to be like January 1 or, you know, how it is sometimes. It takes a while to get all the iron out, all the little details. But that's a wonderful advantage that we're going to have now, because we have women who do develop problems under the age of 40, and often they don't have access to a way to have those problems diagnosed. Locally here in Chico, we are fortunate that we do have the program called Bridging the Gap. And That program is through Canyon Oaks Women's Golf League, and they have provided a fund through the Chico Breast Center to allow women who have breast symptoms who meet the same criteria as Every Woman Counts, which is 200%, to be referred by their clinicians to have diagnostic imaging paid for, a breast diagnostic mammogram and ultrasound through the Bridging the Gap. And so that's, you know, a wonderful program. But now we're going to have that kind of thing available throughout the program, which for me is going to be wonderful because I have 16 counties, and some of my counties are very resource poor, and trying to come up with a way for a woman to get that diagnostic imaging is quite a challenge.
Right, yeah.
Sometimes, you know, we just, you know, try to do everything we can and get a, you know, some kind of program to have her pay, you know, below a sliding scale or whatever, but it'll be so much better once we can actually assure women that if something is found, that, you know, they can have their care. As you know, Chris, the program does have a breast and cervical cancer treatment program.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was going to ask that next.
Connected.
Go ahead.
And so the challenge has been that if you have a symptom, how do you jump over that, you know, gap to get that symptom diagnosed? Because if it's diagnosed, then you're eligible for the treatment program, but it doesn't do you any good to be eligible for the treatment program if you can't get the cancer diagnosed. So this is really helping to fill in that gap of care, and especially since, you know, our women are being seen for, you know, their cervical care, so they're coming to those same providers, and they, you know, often are provided a breast exam just, you know, as part of that well woman check, and then if something is found, it's a challenge to figure out how we're going to get that problem defined. And, you know, a lot of them, of course, end up not being cancer, but the anxiety for a woman while she's in that process of questioning and that fear of not knowing what is there is very much the same as for any woman who does finally end up, you know, finding that it is cancer. When you're in that limbo area, it's very much the same. And I often will say to women that will say, oh yeah, I had a lump, but it wasn't cancer, that to never discount what you go through when you go through that gray area, and often women will even have that be a deterrent for them not to go get screened because their anxiety is so high.
Right.
What might be found.
You know, it's easy to listen to a show like this and have it just kind of roll off the top of your head. So if people needed to review this information about where to go for help because they suddenly are in crisis about their breasts, where can you tell them to turn?
Do you want a specific number, or would you like... They can always call me. You know, Chris, I always accept phone calls from patients and help to facilitate them from point A to point B. So they can call me here at the California Health Collaborative, and my number is 530-345-2483, extension 214. They can... of course, call one of the, you know, local providers. A lot of them, even if they are not doing Every Woman Counts, know about us. I often will receive referrals from some of the private physicians who aren't enrolled in Every Woman Counts. I received two today. Some of the local physicians' offices are becoming aware that there's programs that are available for their women who don't have insurance or have high deductibles.
Right, and that's so important for people to know that there is help out there.
Exactly. Yeah. And if people, if somebody, you know, has a symptom and they call over to Chico Imaging, Chico Breast Imaging, they will refer patients on to us.
Right.
So I get calls all the time.
Yeah. Well, it seems like breast screening has gotten quite a bit more complicated. And I wanted to ask you about some of the controversial stuff and like who and when to get mammograms. A lot of women are confused about that.
Right. Yes. And actually, you know, there are a lot of different guidelines. And the U.S. Task Force, of course, came up with their guidelines. And they feel that a woman doesn't need to start with the mammogram if she's average risk until she's age 50, and then have them every 2 years until the age of 74. The American Cancer Society recently adjusted their starting point to age 45, but with the option that it could start at 40 depending on the individual. And ACOG still recommends starting mammograms at age 40.
And that's an annual, it's an annual mammogram?
Annually. Our program still pays for women to have them annually. And one thing we feel has come out as a good point with some of these adjusted guidelines and differences between the different entities is that hopefully women will be evaluated on a more personal basis. Our program recommends that the clinician look at each woman individually, discuss her personal risk, her family history, her own sense of how often, you know, she's comfortable having the screening, and come up with a plan that fits that individual. Because our program does pay for it every year, we have the ability to have the high-risk woman have that test every year. The woman who says, oh, well, I don't really feel like I want to have it that often, but I do want to have it at least every 2 years, then she and her clinician can choose that. Of course, always advising that woman that if she should notice anything before that time period, to please come back to the provider and be reevaluated. Should she notice any new symptom, discoloration, lump, pain, that, you know, the program is always available for her. And even if there's a situation where she's had a mammogram and it's not time for her annual yet and she develops a prominent new symptom, our program does pay for her to return and be reevaluated and have additional imaging before that year is up. And I really want to stress that because I've gotten so many calls from people who have said, oh, I found a lump, but when I called the clinic, they said it hadn't been a year since my last mammogram, so I couldn't go and have it checked. You know, there really is a difference between the screening mammogram and the diagnostic. And it's amazing to me that sometimes even some clinicians don't know that. I will see it written, screening mammogram for lump right breast at 10 o'clock. And that, to me, that doesn't match because a screening means you have no symptom. There is no clinical finding. It's routine. And a diagnostic refers to the fact that the patient is experiencing a symptom or the clinician has noticed some abnormality, either with the appearance or the, you know, palpation of the breast itself. That brings up the whole clinical breast exam and whether or not it should or shouldn't be done. And I know that's become controversial as well since the U.S. Task Force has stated that they don't think that it's of any value and that it's not necessary. However, in our program, we still very much recommend a clinical breast exam for a multiple of reasons, not only because it gives the clinician an opportunity to talk to the patient about potential symptoms or, you know, to feel for changes, but also the fact of knowing the correct type of exam to order for that patient, because a lot of the facilities that have become very busy have slots that they have created, and sometimes there may not be a radiologist on the premises to read that exam on a screening day. So they're done in batches, like 8 in an hour, and then somebody comes in and reads them that day or the next day, versus a diagnostic exam is scheduled in a longer time period, and with the availability of the radiologist there to consult, to look at the films on site, to talk with the patient, decide if that additional testing is needed, and help explain what is going on in that process. And having a woman who has a potential abnormality in that diagnostic slot really will allow her to have more expedient care and go through the process a lot quicker and obtain referral and additional treatment.
Right. You know, and I really appreciate the depth of your knowledge and you sharing it with us tonight. We've run out of time, but I want to thank you, Patty Molinaro, for all your years of work serving women and men in the local area and with issues of breast cancer, early detection. Patty is the clinical coordinator of Every Woman Counts and also a breast cancer nurse navigator with the California Health Collaborative. And she has generously given us her phone number. It is 530-345-2483, and listen for Patty Molinaro. Thank you, Patty, for being with us tonight on It's Your Body.
You're welcome, Chris. It was really nice speaking with you and sharing information.
All right.
Have a good evening.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right. So I just want to we're going to shift out a little bit. Dr. Gail Kimball is going to be interviewing Junie Banerjee Stevens from the CSUC Counseling Center and Chris Sims, LCSW, licensed clinical social worker. And I'm going to be scooting out of this chair, so want to put on some music and let us shift around a little bit. But I did want to let you know about one thing that's happening tomorrow night that I thought was important. The Gay Men's Chorus of Los Angeles is capping off a week of It Gets Better workshops in each city that it visits, and they're going to be doing a musical theater performance that brings to life the stories of members of the LGBTQ community and their allies. This will be It Gets Better tour is going to be at Laxon Auditorium tomorrow night with 8 different actors who will be telling real-life stories using musical numbers, video production elements, and even collaboration with local artists. This is a very, very important program in terms of helping young people who may feel very alone and isolated due to gender issues. So anyway, it's been my pleasure being with you tonight, and hang on, It's Your Body continues. A little Laura Love.
Questions without a sound, asking would I like to walk through his silent world. Show me how the silent talk, graceful hand, graceful hand, how I long to understand. Does he know?
Hi, this is Gail Kimball, and I'm just delighted to have with me some outstanding professionals who are right in the thick of what we're interested in talking about. And Devani Banjari Stevens is the head of the Counseling Center at Chico State, and Chris Sims is a counselor, licensed clinical social worker. So my first question comes from a decade of working on global youth issues for a book that's now mushroomed into 5 books. And so one of the things that's said most frequently about college students in the U.S. is their fragile teacups that break at the moment of any slightest stress because of their helicopter parents who've been overprotective. And that results in anxiety and depression. So is that a myth? Is that a reaction to the economic situation since the 2008 recession? What's going on?
Well, I can start. So I will say that when I started graduate school in like 1998, there was definitely the primary presenting concern of students who had come to the College Counseling Center was absolutely depression. And it was more students coming in to talk about what's the meaning of life and why am I here and what's my purpose and I don't really know why I'm getting a college degree. That steadily shifted. Now we definitely see anxiety being the top presenting concern. So in terms of it being a myth, I mean, I don't think it's a myth that students are feeling more anxious. I have some hypotheses.
Great.
Would you like to hear them?
I'd love to hear them. Why?
So, yeah, I mean, I think we've talked about this a lot in the Counseling Center, and I can also say, you know, my fellow directors across the country, we're all scratching our heads trying to figure out what is this. And like any issue, it's multifaceted. It's not one singular cause. I do think that in the last 20 years, there has been this shift from kind of normal developmental suffering, right, that comes along with growing up and becoming an adult.
Adolescence,
that storm and stress that I think you mentioned in one of your books. It really has progressed to this culture of fear. And we talk a lot, Chris has a beautiful saying that we use with students all the time that, when I hear students say, I feel anxious or I feel anxiety, I say that means fear. There's something I'm afraid of. And so I think that is definitely something that has shifted, and I think there are multiple reasons that's happened. There was a distinct change after 9/11, and I think just as a culture, we've become more fearful. And I certainly think that that has impacted how people parent. Maybe because I am a parent myself, I'm very defensive of kind of that helicoptering, because I know that parents are trying to do the best for their children. But I do think it has backfired in that, we're more afraid than ever to let our students fail and our children fail and give them a safe place for that to happen.
But one study I saw said that the student self-report of anxiety had increased from 49% in 2009 to 54% in 2014. So that's over half the students saying they feel anxious. Chris, do you want to comment on that, on what you've seen in terms of your clients?
You know, I've had the pleasure of working with a variety of age groups. And so I've been working at the Counseling Center the last couple of years, and I wasn't really sure what to expect. And that had gone through my mind about sort of the fragile college student, because that's a thing, right? That's a rumor out there. But I have been confronted with heroic stories from clients, and it's not easy. Like, the pressures that they face would make anybody anxious. Any thoughts that I had about the mythological fragile college student have been dispelled by my work with them.
Mm-hmm. And what is causing that burden? What are they burdened by that makes them anxious for legitimate reasons?
Mm-hmm. So the patterns that I recognize are a sense of responsibility that's over and above what their real responsibilities are, both to themselves but also to their parents, to try to achieve for their parents, but also their professional goals. And then the lack of self-care. A lack of recognizing how much pressure they're under and how much care they need for themselves to keep up the pace.
So what do you suggest to them in terms of the care? How can they fill up their batteries, charge their batteries?
Yeah, I mean, I will say that one thing that seems to resonate with the students is when we talk about, what is behind or what is underneath that sense of self-worth, right? And so We'll talk about like how, you know, there are all these external things that help us understand, you know, who we are and if we're succeeding. And so we'll talk about like, you know, some days I do well on a test and then the next day my car gets broken into and then the next day I, you know, break up with my partner. And so we all have these series of ups and downs. So someone who has that core strength or that sense of core worth, they have the ups and downs, but it doesn't rock that sense of core self. And I think when I show students, you know, that kind of this picture that I draw for them, kind of demonstrating that or illustrating that, they're blown away because I think it's the first time they really get this message that, oh, you mean if I don't get a job that pays six figures right out of college, that doesn't mean
I'm a failure.
And truly and honestly, like, I think that they are getting that message from day one. I know I did. I know my parents did. You know, so I think we're all sending that message, you know, over and over. So when we talk about self-care with them, it really is a lot of it, like, self-compassion.
And right? Being realistic.
And being realistic. And, I mean, I'm all for meditation. I'm all for exercise. I'm all for all those kind of ways to kind of manage your biology. But we also try to combine that with, like, how can I maybe tweak some of these beliefs I have that are really getting in the way of my well-being.
How much of that comes from the recession, from, you know, the huge student debt and worry about paying that debt? And
yeah, I mean, it's legit stuff that they come to us with. So, again, after 9/11, there was a real shift I saw from students who had come in, again, with that kind of meaning of life question, and it shifted to, I'm stressed out about my financial aid check not coming in because my parents needed to pay the mortgage because my dad lost his job. And so that was a real eye-opener for me that, you know, these things that they're worrying about and, you know, that they're so fragile about, that it was legit stuff. It was legitimate.
What really struck me in terms of how little attention is paid to it in reading national studies, I came across just two that mentioned two sentences each. Young white women are driving the increase in anxiety. And I asked a high school class in Chico about that, but everyone, the boys and the girls, said, yes, we're anxious. Mm-hmm. Yes, we're depressed. And I said, why? And they said, because we're studying. Our parents are pressuring us to get A's so we get into a good college. We're working, some of us. Maybe a quarter of that class was working, doing paid work. They have volunteer activities, so they'll look good for their college app. And then I said, well, what about the girl part? And, of course, what you would expect, the guys said, you know, we're social. They didn't use that word, but we're socialized not to ask for help. Mm-hmm. And then the girls added something that I never would have thought of, was drama. They said, our mm-hmm. girls' friendships are so intense, there's more drama. But I wonder what you two have seen in terms of why. Chris, you said 64% of the clients are female?
Yeah, 65%, which is different from the population of the university as a whole.
Which is 53%.
You know, I think underneath all that stuff, a lot of this stuff is a sense of competition and the idea of what a human life is supposed to be like.
Wow.
You know what I mean? And so there's like this distortion about, like you were talking about, making all these figures, getting out of college and stuff, and whether that's from the media or from their parents or just some idea that they have.
Or the recession.
Yeah, but once that process starts about feeling anxious or depressed, it's a very isolating thing. So I'll see clients and they come in with the same complaints, and they think that they're suffering something unique. Mm-hmm. But it's just because there's a lack of authenticity, maybe, with what it is to be a human being right now.
Because they have too high expectations for their performances?
Or they've been given too high expectations. I mean, I think this is where I'm really shifting gears, that I think everything I learned in grad school is about how to help that individual kind of shift their beliefs and shift their, you know, their behavior. More and more, I'm blaming the environment, right? Students will come in and I'll say, look, this was done to you. I will say, Chris and I both have young kids who are still in school, and I'm concerned, right? Like, even with my own children, I can see how I'm being asked to helicopter, right? I'm being groomed to helicopter in that, like, you know, here's how you can check on your students' grades. Here's, you know, we're really, you know, my kids are in sixth grade, and we're already getting a lot of messages about, you know, here's how we're going to prep them for college. When I was in sixth grade, I'm pretty sure that, you know, I was still, you know, playing with, you know, dolls and, you know, just playing with my friends. And so I think this is an environmental shift. you know, it's this culture of scarcity that I think we really need. That's the paradigm that needs to, that I would like to see shift.
I think that hits the nail on the head. It's neoliberal capitalism's culture of scarcity.
And I think students feel that there's a sense that something's missing from my life. And whether that's like they're comparing themselves or like that competition piece, right?
That and social media really sets that up.
It does. I mean, I'm also very cautious about blaming social media because, like I said, I just came from an event that the students were doing where they're using social media to communicate with each other about their mental health concerns, right? So I think it can be such a powerfully positive tool. But I do think that it's also a way, for me, it's just another way to compare yourself to the Joneses, right? I think we've done it in time in memoriam, right? I don't think that's a new thing. I think it's just faster and easier now.
And you could count how many likes and how many negative comments and your Instagram account or whatever.
And I do think that's real. I do hear from more students who will come and they'll talk about FOMO. So FOMO is the fear of missing out.
That's great.
And they really do have that sense of like, why wasn't, you know, now all my friends are at this bar, this party, you know, and I got left out. So I think that's a real thing, but I have FOMO, right? And I'm supposedly a grown-up. So, you know, I think that for me, it's the same issues that counselors have been dealing with, but maybe we're not, we're not normalizing that struggle as much, and then certainly we're not emphasizing resilience as much. That it's not that you're not going to have struggles, but can you bounce back when you have a struggle?
The other side of the anxiety, depression syndrome is Gene Twenge at San Diego State made a big cult of students who are narcissistic. This generation is really narcissistic. And she bases it all on the NPI, the Narcissistic Personality Inventory. And when I look at those questions, maybe a quarter of them are, to me, positive. That I'm a good leader or that kind of thing. So I really need you psychology experts to explain to me why the NPI is considered a valid instrument of narcissism among young people.
Gail, I don't know about the NPI. I'm sorry about
that. Yeah. What I will say is, doesn't it seem like somebody who calls somebody else a narcissist is a little narcissistic themselves? That's what I always worry about. You know, that, like, who is defining narcissism? And what you describe, I mean, we talk to students all the time about healthy narcissism, right? That that's what self-worth is all about. It's that sense of I am worthy of taking care of myself. I am worthy of my voice getting out there. I'm worthy of my opinion.
She says that narcissism are like Trump, where it's you're look down on other people, don't care about other people, are willing to step on other people, expect to be entitled. So it goes along with
So that's pathology. And so I think what's important to remember is that, you know, pathology generally, you know, that we have base rates, right? So we have you know, just like a bell curve, right? So there's always going to be this element that is more, you know, that narcissism that isn't, that's outside the norm.
It's a disorder.
So do I think that our students, like more of our students are, you know, meet the criteria for a personality disorder? I just haven't seen evidence of that.
Oh, good.
And I agree. And, you know, one of the things that I talk a lot to my clients about, and it goes with that self-compassion piece, is appropriate self-centeredness, where a lot of their responsibilities are hooked into what they think other people need from them. And that's that competition piece, like keeping up with the Joneses, mm-hmm. like you said, or what their parents need, or what their parents expect, what their professors expect. But by being appropriately self-centered, they can sort of consider their own needs.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you find that there are disordered narcissistic people that are on the Trump syndrome, that that are disordered in terms of, because Twenge said it's really common now, it characterizes this generation.
Well, so I mean, the thing that I think remember is, you know, so the heart of a lot of those, you know, pathologies is a lack of empathy. And, you know, I will say that yes, we have students who come in who may not be able to put themselves in somebody else's shoes. But the other piece of that narcissism is, you know, you can, if you just wipe away one layer, it's a real sense of emptiness and like, you know, those students will describe a sense of abandonment. They don't feel like there's a there, right? Like, they don't have a sense of identity that they can hang on to. So, I have a different, when I hear entitled, or when I'm experiencing somebody that I know would be described as entitled by others, I mean, that's part of what we love to get in there and kind of see, like, what is really going on there. And it's often a story of, my needs didn't get met, and I didn't learn how to ask for what I needed.
So I'm going to take it.
Well, yeah, maybe. I mean, maybe, right? Like, so I think it's just, you know, what's hard is that a student who maybe is more dependent and more kind of depressed and more, kind of pulling from us that sense of, you know, compassion, has the same underlying, you know, sense of abandonment, sense of, you know, insecurity or whatever that is. We just, like, our social, you know, structure says it's okay to feel sorry for that person. But somebody who is more aggressive, we're gonna say that, you know, they don't deserve as much of that compassion.
So if you could put a percentage on it, both of you, do you see any kind of narcissistic, you know, on the disordered side in terms of your clients or not?
I wouldn't categorize any of my clients as narcissistic. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm confused about making a claim like that, because then what? You know, if that's the case, then what? Do we not treat them, or do we not offer services
right.
to them?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know the use of holding that perspective. And not to argue with her or anything like that, mm-hmm. but it's sort of like, it's like the fragile teacup thing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, even if that's true, are we supposed to beat up our kids a little bit more?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I don't understand what the basis of that is. And along those lines, I'd like to bring up the topic of stigma, because I think there has been a reduction in stigma, so people are more able and willing to sort of share that they're hurting than they used to be. I think stigma kept a lot of people away from getting treatment in the past, and I think it's a credit to our mental health system and our culture that it's not what it used to be.
Mm-hmm. What about with young men?
You know, I've got a lot of men. I see a lot of men. I run a men's group. It's awesome. Mm-hmm. It's awesome.
But do they report that it's difficult for them to ask for help or express their feelings because they're supposed to be men, the men?
Yeah, and you know what? I'm a man. It's hard.
I noticed.
But it's a good thing to do. And once they take that leap, it's really a cool process to see a guy go through,
mm-hmm.
where it's this thing that he's been ashamed of, and then he realizes, hey, this is how it is, and to become friends with that part that there was so much shame, it's a sacred thing,
mm-hmm.
and it's a joy.
You know, I think one thing that kind of evidenced that change is hugging. It mm-hmm. used to be that men would hardly ever hug, and now they always hug. A lot of times they slap and hug mm-hmm. on the back,
the bro hug.
But they hug.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's a change.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I just want to go back a little bit to this kind of narcissistic, the personality disorder piece. You know, I do remember one of my professors in my personality class talking very directly about, you know, personality doesn't stabilize until you're about 30. And so I'm very reticent to pathologize any of our students with a characterological disorder, at such a young age, because it is normal for them to be playing around with lots of different personality, types, right? Like, they're finding themselves. What I will say, though, is that I am concerned that when somebody is kind of glorified for having some of those characteristics, if you stay a little bit longer in that narcissistic place when you're experimenting with who am I, right? Mm-hmm. And I think to that effect, that I have seen a little bit more, that there's a little bit more permission to be, more vocal about, you know, opinions that might be hurtful to other people. And I think that is definitely real, but, you know, I haven't lived long enough to know if that's, again, like, really vastly different than past generations. But I'm very cautious and defensive of, folks who are going to slap labels on a group of people who are in a state of flux.
But plenty of them are taking pharmaceutical antidepressants, anti-anxiety, anti-bipolar, so they've certainly been labeled. Is
they
that
have.
Healthy or unhealthy?
So I don't think it's black and white. Again, like, this is a big part of the stigma that we work with students is, you know, so if you had diabetes, would I criticize you for taking insulin, right? Well, you should exercise more and you should watch your diet. Well, for some folks, that doesn't work. And even if you weren't able to do those things, you know, that's like the wonderful thing about science, right? Like, we found other ways to help you take care of yourself. And I think that the research is showing that therapy and meds are about equally effective. You get the biggest bang for your buck if you can do both at the same time. I've seen medication. It doesn't change students. It doesn't change people. It gives them the energy to do the work of therapy. That's how I think of it.
Mm.
And there are, like, bipolar disorder. I don't know very many people who can function well. I wouldn't say that. I mean, I think some people have learned to function, you know, on different types of medications and different combinations. But, you know, some of those medications can change people's lives for the better. And once we can get them to a place where they're okay, they've worked through their own stigma and can have compassion for what their body needs.
Mm.
Boy, I've seen some amazing things happen.
Yeah. The fact that they're even in college is due to some of the medications that are available today.
Right. Got to get those neurotransmitters.
Mm-hmm. I mean, think, you know, 20 years ago, what happens to somebody with bipolar disorder or something like that? You know, those can be real blessings.
Yeah.
What about the charge about helicopter parents? We kind of touched on that, because what I always think about is the kids whose parents are on their phone all the time, both are working, give you toys because I don't have time to spend with you. So there, it seems that the other side of that is all the kids who don't have enough time with their parents, or their parents are working three jobs or something, and they're kind of ignored in some ways.
Mm-hmm. So again, you just described my life. So I feel like we have to look at the big picture, right? So if I say it all the time, don't I come into work and every day I say, if I could work 8 fewer hours a week, I think my whole family would be doing, you know, that much better. If I could get home to make dinner before 6:30, our family would be doing better. So I think there's an environmental piece. Do I think that parents can make that choice in other ways, you know, to, like, when you are home, to try to be present? Absolutely. You know, I just was listening to a TED Talk by Julie Lithcott Hames, I think her name is. She wrote a book called How to Raise an Adult.
Mm.
And it's been a wonderful read for me, because she talks a lot about, again, this is like, is this for truly our children's benefit that we're asking about their homework and we're asking about what sports they're doing or asking about what, you know, community service they're doing because they, you know, that'll get them into college? Is it about the kid or is it about the parent? Right? And I think the parents, as parents, we need to be aware, like, okay, as noble as I feel like I'm being by being involved in my children's lives, is this yet another way that I've kind of bought into this idea that if my kid gets into that college, then somehow I'm worth more, right? So you see what I mean? Like, we've all bought into this lie, really.
That somehow more is better. The more lessons, the more
sports.
That
we're not okay just the way we are.
As we are.
I read a really interesting study that kids learn to deal with stress by playing, like playing hide and seek or chase or something. You learn how to deal with stress, primate little ones and human little ones. So if they're never in a free, structured place, they don't learn how to deal with stress.
Right.
I don't want this to be taken the wrong way. I got a Boston Terrier, and one of the things they say about Boston Terriers is they're eager to please their masters. You know what I mean? And I feel sometimes like some of those college students I work with are really eager to please their parents. So they're going to college for themselves, but they're also going for their parents.
Mm-hmm.
and more than failing for themselves, everyone, almost every single one that I've talked to that's been worried about failing a class, the number one concern is, I'm letting my parents down.
Absolutely. And I think that's especially true for, we have, you know, a lot of first-generation students, so they're the first in their families to go to college.
Especially
and
Latinas, Latinos.
Absolutely. And, boy, that is not just their dream, that is a whole, like,
generational
community's dreams. And, you know, so again, like, I think those are the environmental pressures that, you know, for us to say they're not dealing with their anxiety well or they're fragile, I think is too simplistic.
Beautiful.
Anything else that you'd like to add in the couple minutes we have left? 2 minutes? About your students, what you see, what you'd like to see for them?
Yeah, so they need more resources on campus. So I was just reading an article about, you know, as this changes, right, like more students are needing or asking for services, mental health services on campus. You know, every director of a counseling center is going to tell you we need more staff, right? In addition to that, I think the students also are asking for a different kind of counseling. Like, you know, they're wanting something that's a little bit more organic. That's not necessarily this come and go into a room where we're going to close the door and we're going to talk about things in secret. They're more comfortable, like, you know, talking to their peers and talking to people about what's going on. And so I would love to see us be able to, you know, right now we are so impacted that my staff can't get out and do some of that less formal work. And so that's certainly something that a lot of college counseling centers are trying to do, but balancing that with we have people coming through our door that we have to...
That are in crisis, yeah, that you have exactly. to deal with. I invite listeners who are interested in the topic of youth to email me, and I'll share chapters for you to critique and add to. And I want to thank our guests, Dr. Banerjee Stevens and Mr. Sims. That was fascinating. I'm going to put the video on the Global Youth YouTube site, too, so people can check that out. Next month, It's Your Body will be about adoption choices. Peanut Butter and Jelly tune is up next. Is up next. And there's going to be a film called Father Unknown. Our Bravest Search is for Ourselves. And that's about adoption choices. It's going to be November 12th at 2 p.m. at the wonderful pageant theater that we all love with the spaceships on the side. So thanks very much to Chris Nelson for engineering and sharing her spot. And I think we're wrapping up.
Peanut butter jelly time! Peanut butter jelly time!
Peanut butter jelly time!
Baseball bat.
Peanut butter jelly, peanut butter jelly, peanut butter jelly with a baseball bat.
Now way ya, way ya, way ya, way ya.
Now there you go, there you go, there you go, there you go.
Peanut butter jelly.
Baseball bat.
To the peanut butter jelly, peanut butter jelly, peanut butter jelly with a baseball bat. Now tick tack toe, tick tack toe,
let's go.
Tick tack toe,
you got it.
Tick tack toe,
let's ride.
Way up, way up, way up, way up.
Now there you go, there you go, there you go, there you go.
Peanut butter jelly.
Jelly.
Peanut butter jelly, peanut butter jelly,
peanut butter
All right. You are listening to FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. This is your groovy grandma, and I'm a little out of breath, but just want to let you know that It's Your Body was made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Live Life Juice Company, providing locally fresh cold-pressed juices and elixirs. Find the